Chapter 8. 1. That Buck McGinnis was not the man to let the grass go under his feet in a situation like the present one, I would have gathered from White's remarks, if I had not already done so from personal observation. The world is divided into dreamers and men of action. From what little I'd seen of him, I placed Buck McGinnis in the latter class. Every day I expected him to act, and was agreeably surprised as each 24 hours passed and left me still unfixed. But I knew the hour would come, and it did. I looked for frontal attack from Buck, not subtlety. But when the attack came, it was so excessively frontal that my chief emotion was a sort of paralyzed amazement. It seemed incredible that such peculiarly wild Western events could happen in peaceful England, even in so isolated a spot as Sandstead House. It had been one of those interminable days which occur only at schools. A school, more than any other institution, is dependent on the weather. Every small boy rises from his bed of a morning, charged with a definite quantity of devilry, and this, if he is to sleep the sound sleep of health, he has got to work off somehow before bedtime. That is why the summer term is the one a master longs for, when the intervals between classes can be spent in the open. There is no pleasanter sight for an assistant master at a private school than that of a number of boys expending their venom harmlessly in the sunshine. On this particular day, snow had begun to fall early in the morning, and while his pupils would have been only too delighted to go out and roll in it by the hour, they were prevented from doing so by Mr. Abney's strict orders. No schoolmaster enjoys seeing his pupils running risks of catching cold, and just then Mr. Abney was especially definite on the subject. The saturnalia which had followed Mr. McGinnis's nocturnal visit to the school had had the effect of giving violent colds to three lords, a baronet, and the younger son of an honourable. And in addition to that, Mr. Abney himself, his penetrating tenor changed to a guttural croak, was in his bed, looking on the world with watering eyes. His views, therefore, on playing in the snow as an occupation for boys were naturally prejudiced. The result was that Glossop and I had to try and keep order among a mob of small boys, none of whom had had any chance of working off his superfluous energy. How Glossop fared, I can only imagine, judging by the fact that I, who usually kept fair order without excessive effort, was almost overwhelmed. I should fancy he fared badly. His classroom was on the opposite side of the hall from mine, and at frequent intervals his voice would penetrate my door, raised to a frenzied fortissimo. Little by little, however, we had won through the day, and the boys had subsided into comparative quiet over their evening preparation, when from outside the front door there sounded the purring of the engine of a large automobile. The bell rang. I did not, I remember, pay much attention to this at the moment. I supposed that somebody from one of the big houses in the neighbourhood had called, or, taking the lateness of the hour into consideration, that a motoring party had come, as they did sometimes, Sandstead House standing some miles from anywhere in the middle of an intricate system of by-roads, to inquire the way to Portsmouth or London. If my class had allowed me, I would have ignored the sound, but for them it supplied just that break in the monotony of things which they had needed. They welcomed it vociferously. A voice. "Sir, please, sir, there's a motor outside." Myself, austerely. "I know there's a motor outside. Get on with your work." Various voices. "Sir, have you ever ridden in a motor?" "Sir, my father let me help drive our motor last Easter, sir." "Sir, who do you think it is?"
An isolated genius imitating the engine. Brrr, 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 brrr.
I was on the point of distributing bad marks. The schoolmaster's standby, broadcast, when a curious sound checked me. It followed directly upon the opening of the front door. I heard White's footsteps crossing the hall, then the click of the latch, and then a sound that I could not define. The closed door of the classroom deadened it, but for all that it was audible. It resembled the thud of a falling body, but I knew it could not be that, for in peaceful England butlers opening front doors did not fall with thuds. My class, eager listeners, found fresh material in the sound for friendly conversation.
"Sir, what was that, sir? Did you hear that, sir? What do you think's happened, sir?"
"Be quiet," I shouted. "Will you be—"
There was a quick footstep outside. The door flew open, and on the threshold stood a short, sturdy man in a motoring coat and cap. The upper part of his face was covered by a strip of white linen, with holes for the eyes, and there was a Browning pistol in his hand. It is my belief that if assistant masters were allowed to wear white masks and carry automatic pistols, keeping order in a school would become child's play. A silence, such as no threat of bad marks had ever been able to produce, fell instantaneously upon the classroom. Out of the corner of my eye, as I turned to face our visitor, I could see small boys goggling rapturously at this miraculous realization of all the dreams induced by juvenile adventure fiction. As far as I could ascertain on subsequent inquiry, not one of them felt a tremor of fear. It was all too tremendously exciting for that. For their exclusive benefit, an illustration from a weekly paper for boys had come to life, and they had no time to waste in being frightened. As for me, I was dazed. Motor bandits may terrorize France, and desperados hold up trains in America. But this was peaceful England. The fact that Buck McGinnis was at large in the neighborhood did not make the thing any the less incredible. I had looked on my affair with Buck as a thing of the open air and the darkness. I had figured him lying in wait in lonely roads, possibly even lurking about the grounds. But in my most apprehensive moments I had not imagined him calling at the front door and holding me up with a revolver in my own classroom. And yet it was the simple, even the obvious thing for him to do. Given an automobile, success was certain. Sandstead House stood absolutely alone. There was not even a cottage within half a mile. A train, broken down in the middle of the Badlands, was not more cut off. Consider, too, the peculiar helplessness of a school in such a case. A school lives on the confidence of parents, a nebulous foundation which the slightest breath can destroy. Everything connected with it must be done with exaggerated discretion. I do not suppose Mr. McGinnis had thought the thing out in all its bearings, but he could not have made a sounder move if he'd been a Napoleon. Where the owner of an ordinary country house raided by masked men can raise the countryside in pursuit, a schoolmaster must do precisely the opposite. From his point of view, the fewer people that know of the affair, the better. Parents are a jumpy race. A man may be the ideal schoolmaster, yet will a connection with melodrama damn him in the eyes of parents? They do not inquire. They are too panic-stricken for that. Golden-haired Willie may be receiving the finest education conceivable, yet if men with Browning pistols are familiar objects at his shrine of learning, they will remove him. Fortunately for schoolmasters, it is seldom that such visitors call upon them. Indeed, I imagine Mr. McGinnis's effort to have been the first of its kind. I do not, as I say, suppose that Buck, whose forte was action rather than brain work, had thought all this out. He had trusted to luck, and luck had stood by him. There would be no raising of the countryside in his case. On the contrary, I could see Mr. Abney becoming one of the busiest persons on record in his endeavour to hush the thing up and prevent it getting into the papers. The man with the pistol spoke. He sighted me. I was standing with my back to the mantelpiece, parallel with the door, made a sharp turn, and raised his weapon. "Put him up, sport," he said. It was not the voice of Buck McGinnis. I put my hands up. "Say, which of these is the nugget?" He half turned his head to the class. "Which of you's kids is Ogden Ford?" The class was beyond speech. The silence continued. "Ogden Ford is not here," I said. Our visitor had not that simple faith which is so much better than Norman blood. He did not believe me. Without moving his head, he gave a long whistle. Steps sounded outside. Another short, sturdy form entered the room. "He ain't in the outer room," observed the newcomer. "I've been rubbering." This was my friend Buck, beyond question. I could have recognized his voice anywhere. "Well, this guy," said the man with the pistol, indicating me, "says he ain't here. What's the answer?"
"Why, it's Sam," said Buck. "Howdy, Sam. Pleased to see us, huh? We're on the ground floor, too, this time. All right, all right."
His words had a marked effect on his colleague.
"Is that Sam? Hell, let me blow the head off of him,"
he said, with simple fervor. And advancing a step nearer, he waved his disengaged fist truculently. In my role of Sam, I had plainly made myself very unpopular. I've never heard so much emotion packed into a few words. Buck, to my relief, opposed the motion. I thought this decent of Buck.
"Cheese it," he said curtly.
The other cheesed it. The operation took the form of lowering the fist. The pistol he kept in position. Mr. McGinnis resumed the conduct of affairs.
"Now then, Sam," he said, "come across. Where's the nugget?"
"My name is not Sam," I said. "May I put my hands down?"
"Yep, if you want the top of your damn head blown off."
Such was not my desire. I kept them up.
"Now then, you, Sam," said Mr. McGinnis again. "We ain't got time to bore in. Out with it. Where's that nugget?"
Some reply was obviously required. It was useless to keep protesting that I was not Sam. At this time in the evening, he is generally working with Mr. Glossop.
"Who's Glossop? That dough-faced dub in the room over there?"
"Exactly. You have described him perfectly."
"Well, he ain't there. I've been rubbering. Ah, quit your fooling, Sam. Where is he?"
"I couldn't tell you just where he is at the present moment," I said precisely.
"Ah, gee, let me swat him one," begged the man with the pistol.
A most unlovable person. I could never have made a friend of him.
"Cheese it, you," said Mr. McGinnis.
The other cheesed it once more, regretfully.
"You got him hidden away somewhere, Sam," said Mr. McGinnis. "You can't fool me. I'm come through this joint with a fine tooth comb till I find him."
"By all means," I said. "Don't let me stop you."
"Yo, you're coming with me."
"If you wish it, I shall be delighted."
"And cut out that damn sissy way of talking, you rummy," bellowed Buck,
with a sudden lapse into ferocity.
"Spiel like a regular guy, standing there pulling that dude stuff on me. Cut it out."
"Say, why mayn't I hand him one?" demanded the pistol bearer pathetically.
"What's your kick against pushing his face in?"
I thought the question in poor taste. Buck ignored it.
"Give me that canister," he said,
taking the Browning pistol from him.
"Now then, Sam, are you's gonna be good and come across, or ain't you? Which?"
"I'd be delighted to do anything you wished, Mr. McGinnis," I said, "but..."
"Oh, hire a hall," said Buck disgustedly. "Step lively, then, and we'll go through the joint. I thought you's had more sense, Sam, than to play this fool game when you know you're beat. You..."
Shooting pains in my shoulders caused me to interrupt him. "One moment," I said. "I'm going to put my hands down. I'm getting cramp."
"I'll blow a hole in you if you do."
"Just as you please, but I'm not armed."
"Lefty," he said to the other man, "feel around to see if he's carrying anything."
Lefty advanced and began to tap me scientifically in the neighbourhood of my pockets. He grunted morosely the while. I suppose, at this close range, the temptation to hand me one was almost more than he could bear.
"He ain't got no gun," he announced gloomily. "Then you can put him down," said Mr. McGinnis.
"Thanks," I said.
"Lefty, you stay here and look after these kids. Get a move on, Sam."
We left the room, a little procession of two, myself leading, Buck in my immediate rear, administering occasional cautionary prods with the faithful canister. 2. The first thing that met my eyes as we entered the hall was the body of a man lying by the front door. The light of the lamp fell on his face, and I saw that it was white. His hands and feet were tied. As I looked at him, he moved as if straining against his bonds, and I was conscious of a feeling of relief. That sound that had reached me in the classroom, that thud of a falling body, had become, in the light of what had happened later, very sinister. It was good to know that he was still alive. I gathered, correctly, as I discovered subsequently, that in his case the sandbag had been utilized. He had been struck down and stunned the instant he opened the door. There was a masked man leaning against the wall by Glossop's classroom. He was short and sturdy. The Buck McGinnis gang seemed to have been turned out on a pattern. Externally, they might all have been twins. This man, to give him a semblance of individuality, had a ragged red moustache. He was smoking a cigar with the air of the warrior taking his rest.
"Hello,"
he said as we appeared.
He jerked a thumb towards the classroom. "I've locked them in. What's doing, Buck?"
he asked, indicating me with a languid nod.
"We're going through the joint,"
explained Mr. McGinnis.
"The kid ain't in there. Hump yourself, Sam."
His colleague's languor disappeared with magic swiftness.
"Sam? Is that Sam? Here, let me beat the block off on him."
Few points in this episode struck me as more remarkable than the similarity of taste which prevailed, as concerned myself, among the members of Mr. McGinnis's gang. Men, doubtless of varying opinions on other subjects, on this one point they were unanimous. They all wanted to assault me. Buck, however, had other uses for me. For the present I was necessary as a guide, and my value as such would be impaired were the block to be beaten off me. Though feeling no friendlier towards me than did his assistants, he declined to allow sentiment to interfere with business. He concentrated his attention on the upward journey, with all the earnestness of the young gentleman who carried the banner with the strange device in the poem. Briefly requesting his ally to cheese it, which he did, he urged me on with the nozzle of the pistol. The red-moustached man sank back against the wall again, with an air of dejection, sucking his cigar now like one who has had disappointments in life, while we passed on up the stairs and began to draw the rooms on the first floor. These consisted of Mr. Abney's study and two dormitories. The study was empty, and the only occupants of the dormitories were the three boys who had been stricken down with colds on the occasion of Mr. McGinnis's last visit. They squeaked with surprise at the sight of the assistant master in such questionable company. Buck eyed them disappointedly. I waited with something of the feelings of a drummer taking a buyer round the sample room.
"Get on," said Buck.
"I'm one of those two."
"Hump yourself, Sam."
"Call me Sammy," I urged. "We're old friends now."
"Don't get fresh,"
he said austerely. And we moved on. The top floor was even more deserted than the first. There was no one in the dormitories. The only other room was Mr. Abney's, and as we came opposite it, a sneeze from within told of the sufferings of its occupant. The sound stirred Buck to his depths. He pointed at the door like a smell dog.
"Who's in there?"
he demanded. "Only Mr. Abney. Better not disturb him. He has a bad cold." He placed a wrong construction on my solicitude for my employer. His manner became excited.
"Open that door, you," he cried.
"It'll give him a nasty shock."
"Go on, open it."
No one who is digging a Browning pistol into the small of my back will ever find me disobliging. I opened the door, knocking first, as a mild concession to the conventions, and the procession passed in. My stricken employer was lying on his back, staring at the ceiling, and our entrance did not at first cause him to change this position.
"Yes,"
he said thickly, and disappeared beneath a huge pocket handkerchief. Muffled sounds, as of distant explosions of dynamite, together with earthquake shudderings of the bedclothes, told of another sneezing fit. "I'm sorry to disturb you," I began, when Buck, ever the man of action with a scorn of palaver, strode past me, and having prodded with the pistol that part of the bedclothes beneath which a rough calculation suggested that Mr. Abney's lower ribs were concealed, uttered the one word,
"Say!"
Mr. Abney sat up like a jack-in-the-box. One might almost say that he shot up. And then he saw Buck. I cannot even faintly imagine what were Mr. Abney's emotions at that moment. He was a man who, from boyhood up, had led a quiet and regular life. Things like Buck had appeared to him hitherto, if they appeared at all, only in dreams after injudicious suppers. Even in the ordinary costume of the Bowery gentleman, without such adventitious extras as masks and pistols, Buck was no beauty. With that hideous strip of dingy white linen on his face, he was a walking nightmare. Mr. Abney's eyebrows had risen, and his jaw had fallen to their utmost limits. His hair, disturbed by contact with the pillow, gave the impression of standing on end. His eyes seemed to bulge like a snail's. He stared at Buck, fascinated.
"Say, you quit rubberin'. Yous ain't in a dime museum. Where's that Ford kid, huh?"
I have set down all Mr. McGinnis's remarks as if they had been uttered in a bell-like voice with a clear and crisp enunciation, but in doing so I have flattered him. In reality, his mode of speech suggested that he had something large and unwieldy permanently stuck in his mouth, and it was not easy for a stranger to follow him. Mr. Abney signally failed to do so. He continued to gape helplessly till the tension was broken by a sneeze.
One cannot interrogate a sneezing man with any satisfaction to oneself. Buck stood by the bedside in moody silence, waiting for the paroxysm to spend itself. I, meanwhile, had remained where I stood, close to the door. And, as I waited for Mr. Abney to finish sneezing, for the first time since Buck's colleague Lefty had entered the classroom, the idea of action occurred to me. Until this moment, I suppose, the strangeness and unexpectedness of these happenings had numbed my brain. To precede Buck meekly upstairs and to wait with equal meekness while he interviewed Mr. Abney had seemed the only course open to me. To one whose life has lain apart from such things, the hypnotic influence of a Browning pistol is irresistible. But now, freed temporarily from this influence, I began to think, and my mind making up for its previous inaction by working with unwonted swiftness, I formed a plan of action at once. It was simple, but I had an idea that it would be effective. My strength lay in my acquaintance with the geography of Sandstead House, and Buck's ignorance of it. Let me but get an adequate start, and he might find pursuit vain. It was this start which I saw my way to achieving. To Buck, it had not yet occurred that it was a tactical error to leave me between the door and himself. I suppose he relied too implicitly on the mesmeric pistol. He was not even looking at me. The next moment my fingers were on the switch of the electric light, and the room was in darkness. There was a chair by the door. I seized it and swung it into the space between us. Then, springing back, I banged the door and ran. I did not run without a goal in view. My objective was the study. This, as I have explained, was on the first floor. Its window looked out onto a strip of lawn at the side of the house, ending in a shrubbery. The drop would not be pleasant, but I seemed to remember a waterspout that ran up the wall close to the window, and in any case I was not in a position to be deterred by the prospect of a bruise or two. I had not failed to realize that my position was one of extreme peril. When Buck, concluding the tour of the house, found that the little nugget was not there, as I had reason to know that he would, there was no room for doubt that he would withdraw the protection which he had extended to me up to the present, in my capacity of guide. On me, the disappointed fury of the raiders would fall. No prudent consideration for their own safety would restrain them. If ever the future was revealed to man, I saw mine. My only chance was to get out into the grounds, where the darkness would make pursuit an impossibility. It was an affair which must be settled, one way or the other, in a few seconds, and I calculated that it would take Buck just those few seconds to win his way past the chair and find the door handle. I was right. Just as I reached the study, the door of the bedroom flew open, and the house rang with shouts and the noise of feet on the uncarpeted landing. From the hall below came answering shouts, but with an interrogatory note in them. The assistants were willing, but puzzled. They did not like to leave their posts without specific instructions, and Buck, shouting as he clattered over the bare boards, was unintelligible. I was in the study, the door locked behind me, before they could arrive at an understanding. I sprang to the window. The handle rattled, voices shouted, a panel splintered beneath a kick, and the door shook on its hinges. And then, for the first time, I think, in my life, panic gripped me, the sheer blind fear which destroys the reason. It swept over me in a wave, that numbing terror which comes to one in dreams. Indeed, the thing had become dream-like. I seemed to be standing outside myself, looking on at myself, watching myself heave and strain with bruised fingers, at a window that would not open.